maybe you want to think back to where you were in 1990. Because in 1990, that was the year that Nancy started working with us. Back to 1990. 1990, I was in my freshman year of college. I remember all of it. Really. You know, I mean, great, great experience for me, great time of life. Maybe you can remember where you were in 1990. Anybody, those of you who were here in 1990 and of memory age, can you remember something from 1990? Don't worry, if you raise your hand, I'm not going to call on you. Don't worry. Can you remember something from 1990? Those of you in the chat and on Facebook, if you want to write a memory from 1990 that you remember, go ahead and write that down. That's great. We'll enjoy those. But most of you could remember something from 1990. Okay, good. We've got our gray matter stretch for remembering. I want to go a little bit farther back now, okay? You with me? We went to 1990. I want to go back 530 years. Anybody remember what they were doing 530 years ago? Anybody? No hands? Huh, weird. 530 years ago, come on, y'all. Remember what you were doing? 1491, it was a year before 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, you remember? No, nobody? Okay. Maybe this will help. Henry VIII was born in 1491, 530 years ago. Remember Henry? His dad, Henry VII, had just gotten everything back together in England after the War of the Roses. War of the Roses, big English Civil War, not ringing a bell. Any AP World History folks in this room that might, any of this ringing a bell? Medieval times? No, okay. How about the Hundred Years' War? Y'all remember that one? Hundred Years' War, that finished right around 1455, so a little bit later, the Hundred Years' War. Anybody remember who won? The Atlanta Braves won. No, I'm just kidding. That was something different. England lost, just in case you were wanting to know. All right, that's a little silly. None of us remembers 530 years ago. We weren't alive. As a matter of fact, we didn't have a country. As a matter of fact, there was no white history on this continent, except for maybe an explorer who happened to stub his foot on our soil. We hadn't had a colony start, successful colony start in 1491. Europe is all in the Middle Ages, trying to come through to the Renaissance. It's a whole different world. Now, I tell you this because last week we talked about Haggai. Haggai was 518 BC. We have that date pretty clear with biblical archaeology. 518 BC, Haggai. A couple of weeks before, we talked about a guy named Nehemiah. 400, we don't have his date as clear, but maybe 450 to 440 BC, okay? Now today we're going to talk about Gideon. Now remember Haggai, 518 BC. Today we're going to talk about Gideon. Gideon, best we can tell, we can't even pinpoint him to the exact century. Best we can tell, Gideon was 11th or 12th century BC. So we're going to pick a date. We're going to throw a dart at a dartboard. We're going to say 1050 BC, which means where we are today is 532 years before where we were last week. So Gideon walking into Haggai's world would be like Christopher Columbus walking into our world today. Sometimes we read the Bible and we think all this stuff happened at the same time. Sometimes we read this stuff and we get confused by all of this and we end up, because it's so confusing, just throwing it all into one pot. This Old Testament is not the same pot. The world is very different from Gideon to Haggai. Just like you might say the world is a little different from Christopher Columbus to now. Lots has changed. Now, one thing's the same. One thing's the same in the time of Gideon and in the time of Haggai. And I'll just tell it to you. It comes from Judges chapter 6, verse 1. This is the one thing that was the same for the people of Israel. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. That one thing's the same. The people of Israel had made a covenant with God to follow God. They made a covenant to be with him after he delivered them from Egypt. And here, 250 to 300 years after Moses, which, by the way, for us would be like Moses to Gideon was like George Washington to us. That kind of length of time, right? So 250 years after the time of Moses, the people were doing evil in the eyes of the Lord and going off and doing things their own way, following their own gods. Guess what? Haggai is telling the people they've spent too much time focusing on their own affairs rather than focusing on the affairs of God. Nehemiah is telling the people, look, we've got to rebuild this wall because we need to refocus our lives on God rather than on our own ways. This theme continually is happening. So we're going to look at Gideon for the next 3 weeks because we've got some real important things we can learn here. Gideon and the people of Israel are under the subjugation of the Midianites. They are in hiding because they are being overrun by this other tribe, the people of Midian. So they're in hiding, and we find in Judges 6, 11 through 16. We're going to start there. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. He was hiding. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, and he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am least in my family. How can I change the circumstances around us?" The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midians together." I'm going to be honest here. Gideon doesn't sound like that much when we meet him. The Lord greets Gideon with a great greeting of respect. "Greetings, mighty warrior. The Lord is with you." And Gideon scoffs. Gideon scoffs. "The Lord is with us? Right. Then why am I trying to thresh enough grain in hiding to feed my family? The Lord is with us? Why am I afraid for my wife and children because of these Midian marauders? Why do I keep looking at my phone at the security video at my house and seeing Midianites running around taking all of my stuff and nobody stopping them? If God is with us, where are all these incredible acts that we've heard about from Moses? Where are all these things that I heard about that supposedly happened that God did 250 or 300 years ago? Was any of this even true?" Gideon is afraid. He's afraid that God really isn't with the people of Israel at all. And actually, maybe this God isn't even real. He's asking deep, scary questions. But Gideon is afraid of something else. He's afraid that if the answer that God isn't real is actually true, he's afraid of what it means for him. Because if God isn't real, if the stories of the people of Israel are not really true, then they're on their own. And they're going to have to figure out this whole Midianite crisis themselves. If God isn't real, then how does his life matter? You ever felt that way? Have you ever felt like your life is being swallowed up in forces bigger than what you can control and even understand? And that there's nothing you can do to change the narrative? The Lord tells him, "Go in the strength that you have. I'll be with you." And Gideon says, "I don't have any strength. I'm spent. I've spent the last 7 years trying to feed my family when the Midianites are taking everything from us. I've tried to hold a business together. God or whoever you are, I've tried to figure this out the best I can, and I can barely keep clothes on my children. And I don't know where the next week's paycheck is coming from. I don't have any strength right now. My family has no influence. I'm the youngest. How am I supposed to lead anyone? I'm just trying to hold it together. You ever been there? Maybe you can relate to some of that fear, some of that loss, some of that doubt. I know I can. We live in a culture now overwhelmed with anxiety and grief. Our family members are stressed, strained, and shattered. Teachers, nurses, doctors, restaurant workers and owners, business owners are facing financial and medical struggles. Too many people in our congregation and in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, feel their lives snowballing. Is there any wonder that so many people are living like Gideon right now, hunkered down, trying to make it through the next week, and not really sure if things are going to get much better? Friends, that may not be where you are, but I promise you, people living near you, maybe even living with you, are there. Our neighbors, our city, people we know, people in our families are worn out, worn down, and spread thin. And like Gideon, when someone suggests, "It's okay, God is with you," they smile and say, "Where?" Or maybe they smile to appease you and say, "Well, yeah, I know, but." Or maybe they say, "I stopped going to church in the pandemic and I didn't miss it, because I don't know that I'm feeling very much of God in the church right now." Or maybe they say, "I used to believe in God, but now if he's there, he's just a distant idea to me." Maybe they say, "I used to feel God's presence when I pray, but lately, I just feel empty." Or maybe they say, "It's been a long time since I've been able to pray." If you've ever been there, that's where Gideon is. That's where this guy, over 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, is. And to me, it feels like now. Because I know too many people, and I've experienced too much of it myself, this hunkered down reality. If you pay attention and listen more than you talk, you're going to notice that this is where our world is. This is where our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, people we don't know as well, this is where they are. I'm reminded of the words of Thomas Paine, who wrote in the American Revolution, "These are the times that try men's souls." Believe it or not, friends, we are in a time that tries our souls. I am so glad that God sees more in us than the weight of our times. I'm even more grateful that the weight of the times does not upend God's purpose. In this hunkered down, minimal man of a farmer, Gideon, God sees a warrior. I wonder, friends, what does God see in you? Could it be that God sees in you and in me, in our church and in our city, way more than what we imagine? And yet we feel empty. Maybe it doesn't matter how much we have left in us. Maybe it matters more who is with us. In a few short weeks, we will be celebrating Advent, where we will read the story again of Emmanuel, God with us. God knows more about getting the best out of our lives than we do. Gideon feels something awaken in him. Although he's not quite sure what it is, he's not quite sure how to categorize it. Judges 6, 17 through 24, Gideon says this. He says, "If I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away till I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." The Lord said, "I will wait until you return." Gideon went, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah of flour, he made bread without yeast. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered to him under the oak. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on the rock, and pour out the broth." And Gideon did so. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. When Gideon realized that this was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But God said to him, "Peace, do not be afraid. You are not going to die." So God built an altar to the Lord there. Gideon built and ordered an altar to God there and called it, "The Lord is Peace." To this day, it stands in Ophrah of the Abezerites. About this moment, I'm thinking Gideon is going, "You know, I really wish I hadn't told God that he's not with us. I really wish I'd been a little more careful with the things I said in front of God," because I can imagine as that offering is zapped up, I can imagine at that great zap, Gideon is feeling very nervous. And yet God says to him, "Peace be to you. My peace on you." In response to Gideon's fear, God speaks peace. What would it mean for your life today for God to speak peace over you? Over the questions that are stirring in your soul, over the anxieties you have about your finances, over the fears you have about the future, over what's happening to you medically, over what concern is going on in your life right now. What would it mean for God to speak peace over you? What would it mean for God to speak peace over your life today? What would it mean for God to speak peace over our church and our city? What if the miracle of this story isn't the zapping of the offering, but it's the extension of peace in the midst of chaos? Because, friends, we spend a lot of our time trying to manage chaos. What if we spent our time and energy trying to live in peace in the chaos? Because, you know, the more we try to manage our circumstances, the more we realize there are things we can't control. What if our lives became about living in the peace of Christ in the midst of what we can't control, rather than trying to spend our existence flailing and trying to control what is uncontrollable? I remember the words of Jesus to his disciples the night he was arrested. He says, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not let them be afraid." I remember Jesus saying to them, "I don't give you peace as the world gives. Do not try and define the parameters of your life by your circumstances that you can't control. Instead, define your life by living in the hand of God's peace." This same peace that God proclaims over Gideon, that Jesus left with his followers, is the peace that God proclaims over us. Not a peace that says, "Don't worry, be happy." Not a peace that says, "Let go, let God." Not a peace that says, don't worry, everything's going to be all right. It's a peace that says, even if things aren't all right, I am with you. And I will make a way for you. Because trust me, friends, there's going to be time in your life where things ain't all right. And we can either spend our life trying to live the mirage of making everything all right, or we can spend our lives in the moments of crisis leaning on the one who gives peace beyond the crisis. God pronounces peace over Gideon. Now, as we close, let's turn to a final portion of the scripture. We're going to skip the episode in Judges 6, 25 through 35. That's an often undertold part of Gideon's story. We're going to look at that next week as a part of our conversation. But right now, look with me at Judges 6, 36 through 40. This is something you may have heard from Gideon's story that is very interesting. 36 through 40, what we read is this. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand as you have said." And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. This time, make the fleece dry and the ground covered with dew." That night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. Not only does Gideon sound a little weak, he sounds kind of demanding, doesn't he? It's not God give me, it's God show me so I know I'm doing the right thing. Give me a sign, God. I don't know about you, but I grew up being taught, don't ask God for signs. It shows a lack of faith to continually be asking God, God, show me a sign. Show me what's happening. Sometimes we just have to live by faith. I grew up being taught this. I was taught this not from a bad place. We remember the temptation narrative of Jesus, where Jesus is tempted by the devil to do a sensational miracle. And Jesus says, Satan, you don't put the Lord to the test. And then we remember a story of Jesus with a crowd of Pharisees who are asking him for a sign to prove who he is. And we read this in Matthew 12. It says, "Some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, 'Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you.' But he answered them, 'An evil and adulterous generation asked for a sign. But no sign's going to be given except the sign of the prophet Jonah.'" An evil and adulterous generation asked for a sign. Why is it okay for Gideon to ask for a sign? He does it three times. Two with the fleece, and then he says, "Hey, wait on me while I bring this offering and show me that you're God." What's going on here? Why is it so different when Jesus condemns people for seeking signs and yet Gideon asked for signs? I think there are two important differences. I can't answer the question fully because I got to tell you, I'm wrestling with this one. But I do see two things that I think are very different about what Gideon does. The first one is his posture toward God. Even as Gideon is questioning, even as Gideon is wrestling with his own doubt, his first sign he wants to see from God is a sign that requires his full devotion and worship. Look what Gideon does. He says, "Wait here." And he doesn't go and pick up something at 7-Eleven. He doesn't go pick up a can of all-beef Vienna sausages over at Wawa and bring that for the offering. He goes and finds a goat and makes broth, which is not a quick process, friends, and prepares the goat And then he bakes unleavened bread. Again, there's no microwave here. This takes all day. Oh, and by the way, this isn't a time of scarcity. How long did it take him to find a goat when you know the Midianites are out there looking for every animal? I bet Gideon hadn't eaten meat himself in weeks. And he goes and he gets these things and he brings them back to God. Even in his doubt, even in his questioning, he brings God the best he has. And he postures himself in worship in front of God. These Pharisees, they say, we want to see a sign. They haven't given any devotion to God at all. They haven't given any devotion to Jesus. They've shown no worship. Their motivation, their posture in front of Jesus is, we think you're wrong. We think you're dangerous. And we're not going to believe even if you show us a sign. Jesus has already done healings in front of them. He's already miraculously provided food in front of them. They didn't need a sign. They've seen many signs. They just don't want to believe. Because if they believe, it's going to make them change everything. Gideon bows and offers God his best. The Pharisees offer God nothing. They wanted to see and feel the power of God without any commitment and change on their part. Everybody wants to see the power. Very few people want to change. Gideon teaches us that there are no signs without sacrifice. You have to bring a posture of giving your very best to God. You have to give great preparation to investing and seeing what God is doing in the world. Because, friends, the Pharisees were blind. God was doing things all in front of them. The Son of God was right there. And they missed it. The Pharisees teach us that even when God gives signs, we can miss them when our lives are immersed in self-absorption. We can be blind to all the signs that are in front of us. Gideon waited by the fleece and asked God, please move. I've had the privilege many times in my life to spend days at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Conyers, Georgia, and those days are spent praying, reading, listening, and in silence. They are days that are restorative and very unnerving. It is not easy to be alone with God and your rawest self. If you don't believe me, I suggest you try it sometime. It's not easy. One of the things the monks at this particular monastery they do is they have a regular rhythm of worship and prayer. And that regular rhythm of worship and prayer is corporate, which means they worship together. And that rhythm begins at 4:30 a.m. Yes, they go to church at 4:30 a.m. It's still dark. And they read their prayers. They chant and they sing and they pray, and then they turn to the windows and they sit down. And they sit there for 30 to 40 minutes in silence. Did I mention it was 4:30 in the morning? They don't fall asleep. They look eagerly to the window. As soon as the first rays of the sun break through the window, they stand and sing praise to God and give thanks for the sign of God's faithfulness that a new day is dawning. Friends, what if we spent more of our time eagerly watching and waiting for the signs of God's presence than we do spending time worrying over the circumstances we can't control? we have the opportunity to lay out and sit beside the fleece, because God is going to do God's work. It's a question of whether we'll see it or not. May our eyes be open to the peace that God pronounces over us. I'm going to invite our Transform Praise Team to lead us in worship again. And as they do, I'm going to invite you to sing, but I'm also going to ask you to pray. Pastor Walter and I are going to be at the back of the room. If you'd like to pray with us, we'd be honored to pray with you. Maybe you have questions. Maybe you have doubts about your faith that you just like to verbalize and know that it's going to be okay. Know that we're not going to try and fix you, but we're just going to pray with you. Maybe this is a time you'd like to pray at the altar on either side. It's open. Maybe this is a time you simply need to sit next to God and hear His peace. Wherever you are, this is your time. Let's stand and let's sing.